me just ask some questions. And let's see, I want to make sure I know how to do this part. I want to ask the questions and you be able to say it. I don't know if we're working with sound or not yet, but Scott, you can tell me what to do. Here's my first question. You guys, okay, I got the chat window available. Name the woman who saved Israel with the tent peg. Who was the woman who saved Israel with the tent peg? And yeah, there you go, JL. And now for 15 points, what was her tribal affiliation? What was the name of her people? She was not actually an Israelite, but associated with them. JL. And 1001, 1002, no takers on that. And it's JL the Kenite. Okay, somebody missed the 22 point question there. Here's the next one. This one's pretty easy. And I'd like to know the name of the left-handed warrior judge. Who do we got going on now for that one? And Ehud is right. This one I'm serious about. It'll sound like it just I'm being a smart aleck, but I'm not. Do pets or animals have souls? Ecclesiastes 3:21. And the answer is, oh, Holiday says no. And Jordan says yes in Hebrew. All right, well, Holly, I'll split your answer with Jordan's, because Solomon actually says, who knows? Now, because if a person says your favorite dog does, then what about cows, pigs, moose, deer? So if animals do have souls, is it right to eat them? What about that? You know, should we just be ultra vegans and make sure the plants we're eating don't have souls? So is it right to eat anything you want? Just don't eat them while they're alive. Well, yeah. And so that's right. Holly, good. You've gained back your points. Peter's vision, Acts 10, and related places. 1 Timothy 4:4. Okay. Here's a fun question for you. Which is mentioned more often in the Bible, dogs or cats? Which is mentioned more often in the Bible, dogs or cats? And the answer, of course, is dogs. Actually, 41-0. Here's my last question. Scott's back, ready to go with us. Is the implication that God loves dogs more than cats, and therefore we should also? What's the answer? And Kotenbaas says, I like it.
This is almost as bad. Talking about cats and dogs is almost as bad as talking about politics. Cats versus dogs. Like, the people are, well, yeah, Jordan, again, with the loaded questions.
The Lion of Judah is a cat. Oh, wow. Hadn't thought about that angle to it, because dogs are mentioned 40 times more than cats. Well, that's probably no longer true if you consider lions now, which are mentioned quite a bit. And dog is mostly negative.
Yes.
And lions are mostly positive, except a live dog is better than a dead lion. Whew, good stuff, class. Scott, over to you.
Okay. To be fair to the lion thing, there's also the devil goes about like a roaring lion.
Oh,
so
yeah.
There's that piece of it too. But yeah, either way, best to be neutral on the dog versus cat debate. You're not going to win no matter what. But we're going to go ahead and we're going to get started in class. We're all live and everything now. Paul's going to lead us in prayer, and then we're going to get into looking at some of the kings.
All right, class, let's go to God. Heavenly Father, we are honored and we are blessed to be your children, even allowed the privilege to go to you. And Father, whatever we don't say quite right, or that we don't say expansive enough or humble enough, Father, may the Spirit translate our hearts to your heart. Father, for those that have lost loved ones to the coronavirus, like the Wayne Ralston family. Ben Kotenbaugh has relatives that are in their 90s and facing it. Others have other issues, whether it happens to be the John Dorn family with cancer, others with health issues, Jim Potterbaugh, and people all over the state, all over the world. Father, we ask for your compassion. First of all, protect the saints. Father, though we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, we will fear no evil. Father, we look for your protection. We want to do wise things, that we're not tempting you, but we are asking for your covering and your help in all that we do. Help the Christians to struggle with other things, whether it happens to be finances or mood, depression, or whatever it is. God, we are your flock. We are the children of your family. Thank you so much. Watch over all of us. Watch over our world. Watch over our government and other governments. May the peoples of this world be drawn closer to you. Thank you for this privilege of prayer. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Okay, so we are we're in Kings here, and we're kind of trying to do this a little bit differently. We're trying to focus on the personalities of these kings, which I think is really one of the more interesting parts of Kings. Kings is a section of the Bible. If you're not careful, you can kind of find yourself snoozing through or just getting frustrated by. And what we want to do is highlight who these people are and why they did what they did, and look at them as a case study and examples of both good and bad behavior. And I like to put it this way, that you have cases of good kings who did bad things, and you have cases of bad kings that did some good things. And so people are messy, and that's a value to look at. So what I'm going to do, something we haven't done in the past year, but we have the capability of, is to try and throw up a screen of the king's timeline. Now, we're not going to be looking at all of the kings, but what we have done at this point is we have looked at the United Kingdom. We've looked at Saul, David, Solomon. So this, the time period in which the kingdom was united under one ruler. Now we're moving into a time period where that's beginning to change. And so as we move to that time period, we're now seeing this divided kingdom. Now, one way to look at that would be to try and chronologically sync them up. So we look at the northern kingdom, and then we go back to the southern kingdom. We go back to the northern and back to the southern as the kings overlap. That's not what we're going to do. What we're going to do is we're going to look at just the northern kingdom first. And as we look at that northern kingdom, we'll eventually go back to the southern kingdom. But for now, what we're going to be looking at here to start with are Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Tibni, Omri, and Ahab. Now, we'll see how much we get through in that section. But the heavy hitters, as I think Paul put it this way, the heavy hitters in this section are Jeroboam the first and Ahab. The others, they just don't have quite as many interesting bits, so we won't spend as much time on them. But primarily we'll spend our time on Jeroboam the first and on Ahab. But that's kind of gives you a little bit of a lay of the land. We're not going to keep this chart up here the whole time, but we do want to kind of give you a general overview. So we'll look at that northern kingdom that's made out of the 10 tribes of Israel, not the southern kingdom right now. So, Paul, you have anything you would add to that?
No. Do you want to give a quick overview now of what we just looked at with the first three kings, and then jump into Jeroboam, or jump into Jeroboam?
Yeah, we can do that real quick. I think that's especially since to understand Jeroboam, you kind of have to know those first three guys okay. A little bit. So, right, you got Saul. He's the king that the people wanted. He had all the outward trappings, but inwardly just wasn't up to the task. He's kind of this mixed bag, complicated character, but ultimately just wasn't faithful enough, was not really committed and the type of man you want as a leader. Then you have David, flawed in terms of making mistakes. He sometimes would look leap before he looked, but faithful to the Lord. Then you have Solomon. He's got everything going for him, has asked for wisdom. God's given him that and riches and power and everything. The kingdom expands greatly under his role and reign. But then ultimately, he is undone by his marriages and his willingness to accept idolatry for his wives. That is what sets the stage for what will become the divided kingdom, because God will say in, where is it, about 1 Kings 14, maybe a little earlier, 1 Kings 11, we'll see that God raises up adversaries for Solomon, makes life difficult for him. So a lot of that peace starts to go away because he's not been faithful. And then tells him that I'm going to give 10 of the tribes to somebody else, to your adversary. And you get to keep two, your lineage gets to keep two, really not because of Solomon, right? He gets to keep them because of David and God's promises to build an enduring house for David. So that's what leads to where we are. So Solomon actually, as his he ended his reign, knew this was the end of a dynasty.
Great, great point. And so God says, look, Solomon, you introduced all this idolatry and you're losing the kingdom, but because of David, it won't happen just yet. Well, that fast forwards us now into Jeroboam the First. And the thing for us to think about, just a side note, later on, there's another guy named Jeroboam, and there's kings with the same name in, I'll say, different time zones. And so this is, generally, we just think of him as Jeroboam, but more accurately, probably Jeroboam the First. Mm-hmm. Scott, do you want me to cover some of the Jeroboam stuff and then turn it back over to you?
No, I think that that's a great way. If you could kind of take a look at some of the Jeroboam stuff, and as Paul said, Jeroboam the First, or Jeroboam, oftentimes you'll see him referred to as Jeroboam, son of Nebat. When I'm teaching the high schoolers, what I always try and do when I teach Jeroboam, son of Nebat, because he's the guy who will be brought up all the time, is I pretend I'm swinging a bat at one of their knees and they never forget it. So it's son of Nebat. But how about you kind of cover him? Let's do an overview and then we can, you know, maybe move into more application too, if that works.
Okay. And class, Scott and I talked about this. What we'd like you to do, we'll come and we'll talk about some of these really interesting principles. As we do it, the application is going to occur. Wait a minute. This is how this actually applies to us or in our society or in governments that we've seen. So let's get started with Jeroboam. He's the first, going to be the first king of the northern kingdom, which now comes to be called Israel, and the southern one, Judah. And he is an Israelite, full-blooded Israelite, and from the tribe of Ephraim. Ephraim, very large tribe, very prideful, and such as this. One of the interesting things we find from 1 Kings 11 is the kind of person he was. He's described as a valiant warrior, a young man, but courageous, industrious. And in 1 Kings 5, Solomon had all these building projects. And so you just didn't have enough talented free labor or whatever. So they drafted him. I mean, now if you're an Israelite, you've got to serve so much time. And this guy, Jeroboam, was a strong enough person. Solomon put him over the forced labor. But of course, Solomon has been just going downhill. And here, men, I mean, you'd be able to handle this. Your family would be happy if you had 700 wives and 300 secondary wives. Your wives wouldn't mind that at all. you know, you can share washing the dishes and such as that.
Or not. Cause any sort of internal angst within the family to have that going on. Yeah, no big deal.
Oh, mercy. Well, so he comes across this prophet, or maybe Ahijah, the prophet, comes across him, takes his cloak off, tears it all up, gives Jeroboam 10 pieces and says, you're going to get it. And here's something I want us to talk about. I'll mention some of the character qualities he had. And then you think about applications to life. Here's a handful of things. Then we'll turn it over to the class, and then Scott could comment on a little bit. He was really politically astute, that he said in 1 Kings 12 that if the people keep going down to Jerusalem to offer sacrifice, they will likely return to the house of David. People say, you know, it was David, and then there was Solomon, and that's what we are supposed to be doing. How do we get to doing this? And he said, you know, unless we do something, this great little kingdom I have inherited won't continue. He was personally astute in verse 27. I said, and if they do that, you know, some people are going to want to still have me as king. They're going to kill me. And so I'll be voted out of office. He was practically astute. He sought advice in verse 28. He was psychologically astute. He gave the people a reason why not to go. You know, it's too much for you to do that. Yeah, think about it. If every Sunday you had to drive to Eugene, Oregon, you'd say, oh, man. And so what he did is he installed a phony priesthood and had fake festivals. You know what? We got our priests right here. It's not exactly the same, but that's what the people of Judah do. And under their abusive king, we've got a more socially understanding king, and he's for us. Think about this, class. Every one of Northern Israel's 19 kings followed calf worship once Jeroboam initiated it. Not one ever attempted to bring the people back to God, because if he did, that'd be political suicide. And a little over 200 years, the northern kingdom, Israel, disappeared forever. So class, think about what lessons we might learn from that. And Scott, let me take a break and you comment on things from there if you like.
Well, yeah, I think you bring up really good points with Jeroboam, in that here's this guy that politically seems to have it figured out. I mean, even all the way back to the beginning, when Rehoboam becomes king for a very short little window over the United Kingdom, he sees, okay, the people and the taxation, and here's the moment. And so they, you know, they wrap him into it, and he becomes part of the kind of the rebels that are saying, you know, if Rehoboam won't lighten your tax load, come with me. So he sees the political moment. He's very aware of those things. But the problem is that he's also very fearful, because he's relying on his own strength. He's a guy who says, well, if this happens, then this will happen. And if the people go down there, then I'll miss out on this. And those are all pretty logical conclusions, except for one thing: who gave him the kingdom in the first place? That's the piece of the puzzle that he misses. And I think that's where a lot of the application with Jeroboam can come in, is you look at things and you say, okay, if you remove God from the equation, you're kind of back to Ecclesiastes, right? If there is no God, vanity of vanities, and I'm left to my own strength and devices. But leadership with God in it isn't fearful. It doesn't have to worry about what might happen here or there. You just say, look, whatever God said, we're going to do that, and we're going to roll with it. So I think there's a major leadership skill that was lacking, and ultimately it became the most important one.
Great point. Leila says, if you'd been paying attention, God gave him the kingdom. And he would know his kingdom would do better by following the Lord. And he said, oh, yeah, yeah, I know, I got it. But I've got to follow man's ways. And now I've got my little political machinery going. And think about how politics are. Ethics and religion are important in politics, only so far as they are tools to get your other aims. That basically they're irrelevant in modern politics, except that if we can get these people voting for us or this or that. And so we face things that are not promote things the world doesn't think is very popular. And it may not be, because the broad gate and the wide way a lot of times isn't right. And true believers ask, what does the book say? Not just, is that cool? And so that's true. Examine our leaders. Here's people say, talking to a guy a couple weeks ago, why would you be for Trump? Well, not actually for Trump, but the problem that I had with the Democratic leaders, they're promoting homosexuality and let's kill our babies. And so we're looking for the principles that God has installed. So you have the first king, he sets the machinery in motion, and everybody said, yeah, me too. And then you come next to these list of kings. They're either going to be the son of the last king or some military tough guy that, hey man, I'm gonna bump him off. So that brings us to the next king, Nadab. I give him a little nickname, Nadab the not so good. He's son of Jeroboam. He only rules 2 years. And as in all the rest of the kings, there's not a lot to say about these middle guys there. 1 Kings 15:26, and he walked in the way of his father. So, oh yeah, and whatever they're doing for religion, yeah, I'm doing this the same sort of thing. And here Leilah says the story of the rich man and Lazarus, how the rich man was told his brothers wouldn't believe even if they saw one return from the dead. These kings saw things that could only be done with the help of the Lord. Still, what do they do? I'm going to do my own thing. So here's Nadab, and the question I have on a handout, and students, if you're interested, we can get you one. If you're not, write to Scott, and he'll make sure you get one. Those that choose to can do a little one-page homework for the class. What was my question number 10 was, what was Nadab? Now, so here's Jeroboam, set the machinery in place. What was Nadab doing? He gets assassinated. What was he doing as the assassination takes place? Somebody got to come up with that, and that's 54 points. Nobody?
Should be all chapter right. 15.
Not on that handy dandy 54 yeah. points. Actually, his army is laying siege to this particular city. And so the next guy up, Baasha, he's a different tribe. He's out of the tribe of Issachar. And it is said that what happens is that he conspired. So it wasn't just him. He had somebody that he was talking with, and here's what we can do. And so they bump him off. And Baasha of Issachar becomes the next king.
And I do think, finish up there. Sorry.
No, I'm good.
One thing that you bring up there with the conspiracy is we're seeing something that has not happened before in Israel. When Saul was replaced by David, the lineage changed, the dynasty changed, right? So Saul's lineage is replaced with David's, but David didn't kill him. David didn't conspire against him.
Right.
Now you have this internal problem where the leadership has turned into a corrupt leadership. Because once you move into that mode, right, of we can overthrow this guy, then when the next guy comes in, guess what the people do who don't like him? Oh, well, we can overthrow him too. So there's a change in leadership style, which is really you get to be leader as long as you're strong, which matches Jeroboam. Because yeah. Jeroboam was that way, wasn't he? He said, well, man, I need to have a slick program here to keep all the people together. So all of this does kind of trace back to what Jeroboam had created, a power struggle that was not based upon faithfulness or goodness or, as you mentioned, morals and ethics. It was based off of who's the slickest, who's the most powerful, who's the most eloquent. And the moment you show any sign of weakness, man, your enemies are in there and they're going to get you. I mean, he's fighting a battle supposedly to protect the Israelite nation, the 10 tribes. And while he's fighting that battle against the, if I remember, it's the Gibbethon, yeah, where that was where the Philistines were, his own people turn on him. You think about, imagine that today, the U.S. military goes out to protect the U.S. and during that time, the other half of the military overthrows the government.
Yes. And you find that repeatedly in governmental situations, the military coup, the cut. Yeah. And so yeah. This guy's got his back turned. Well, let's just stab him. Think about this. And I'd be interested if, you know, maybe I'm the only one ever thought about it, but I'd thought in the younger years, and man, wouldn't it be great if we had some name, great name that you'd be remembered throughout all history. Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, Napoleon, Albert Einstein, Sylvester Stallone, the Beatles, some name, because the reality is, our name's not going to be written in the history book. But then you think about that, of the people that are, were they happy people? Were yeah. they things that you say, oh man, yeah, that's not that I just like their name and popularity. You got to go everything that goes with it, the craziness and alcoholism and assassination and these kind of things, the degradation. More, you do have a name and it is important and it is logged down in a history book. You're logged into the Lamb's Book of Life, Revelation 21, 27. And so you moms and you dads are making names for you in the lives and the souls of your children for all eternity. Keep up the good work. Scott?
Well, and you know, as Paul had talked about, as we're looking at these and looking at leadership examples, you know, what are some, and these are types of things that people could maybe put in the comments and chat, is what are some applications to Jeroboam and the guy who had everything going for him? He had these promises from God. He has a kingdom handed to him, but then he's also the guy who institutes the golden calf at Dan and Bethel so that the people cease to worship God, and how that turns out with him. What are some applications to us? None of us are likely to ever be in charge of a kingdom, right? I highly doubt that that's on my bucket list, to be king somewhere. But we do all have a dominion. So is there, in our own lives of dominion, what are some things that we need to make sure and be thoughtful of that we show the right kind of character? And that, by the way, gets passed down because Nadab, his son, who, as Paul said, he's Nadab not so good. what's said about him? He walked in the ways of his father. Yeah. So yeah, as you look at Jared puts leading your family and leading them, you know, based off of biblical principles is a huge thing. That's an area of dominion.
Yeah. Scott, when you said, you don't, none of us are likely to be leaders of a kingdom. Scott, in all genuineness, you are the first person I thought of. You got this beautiful little family. You're the leader of that family. They depend on you to make good decisions. You say, oh goodness. But the reality is, dads, all of you husbands, you know that old statement, a man's home is his castle. You have the kingdom. You're the head of that. Be a godly, wise, strong leader moms, you're the queens. You have such a lifelong and an eternity long impact. Now, what are some other realms there are beside leading your family? Realms of there's kind of a kingdom that you're in charge of. Yeah, 1,001, 1,002.
Yeah, we'll see if people put some things in the comments there of other areas of dominion and leadership. You know, one thing to think about in terms of one we have there is a business, workplace, being a supervisor at work. Yeah, there's people underneath you.
Elders in the congregation.
Yep.
Community leadership and academic PTA. Yes, deacons. Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, elders are a good example of where God very specifically says, don't lord it over the flock, right? That good leadership isn't concerned about losing power. That was Jeroboam. I'm afraid I'll lose power. That doesn't make for good leaders. Yeah. Good leaders aren't really worried about the source of power. They're more concerned about, did I do right by my people? Whether those people be little people like your children or, you know, other people in the business or whatever the case may be, or in the case of elders, watching over the souls of the flock, something of which you're very familiar with, Paul. And it's not a light burden that a man carries.
No. You're to give an account. Okay, Scott, what if we move on now to Baasha?
Yeah, perfect.
Baasha, I nicknamed him Baasha, bad as the rest. Why? Well, guess what he's doing religiously? Well, he's walking in the way of Jeroboam, more of this calf worship stuff. And he fulfilled a prophecy in 1 Kings 15 to wipe out. So here was Jeroboam and Nadab. Oh, we got our house built. Man, we're getting a dynasty. Yep, dynasty of two. Because you're going in the wrong direction. And over dinner, Glenda had, I talked to her about application, and she said, you know, that Psalm 127, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain who build it. And so
huge, it's not
built on God. So here's Baasha. He conspires against the previous king. What he's going to do is wipe out the line of Jeroboam, so I don't have any people trying to vote me out of office again. But he's doing all the same kind of things like Nadab, and so he gets the same kind of prophecy. Mm-hmm. You are going to have your entire family line wiped out. Now, how would you like that? To say, okay, I'm a king, but man, everybody is going to be executed. Scott?
Well, and one of the big points there is not all of them had committed the sins, right? But everybody's affected by bad leadership.
Good point.
So there's the consequences. When you are in a position of leadership, the consequences are no longer just for you. If I'm just kind of my own guy and I'm low man on the totem pole and I blow it and I get fired, you know, they just hire another bottom rung of the ladder and slide it in and we're fine. But when you are the CEO of a company, when you have all these people relying on you, you know, you think about some of these scandals that happened with companies where they were embezzling money from the top down. People lose their livelihood. People lose their retirement, all these sorts of things. It's devastating when people in positions of leadership don't take it seriously. And so you have this this really powerful statement being made about leadership, I think, in that these guys, everybody in their family tree suffered for that. Everybody suffered for their failings.
Holly mentions, it brings up an interesting question. Is he the son of Ahijah the Shilonite who prophesied to Jeroboam? What you'll find is you'll have names of prophets and kings sometimes being the same. You have a Jehu that's a king and a Jehu that's a prophet. And so I saw that similarity of name, but I don't know if it is identity. So Holly, here's the question for you. Get on your little iPhone and see if you can find out that little piece of information. What we do know is that this Baasha is called a son of Ahijah. He is from the tribe of Issachar, and he rules 24 years. And then he has a son called Elah, and he didn't rule for as long, so I called him Elah the Easily Forgotten. And, you know, same kind of attitude. I'll just follow along the way we've been going. And to me, the one of the interesting things is what he was doing when he was assassinated. Now, he's assassinated by a military official in his own army. Mm-hmm. I call him a tank commander. He was a chariot commander. And Zimri, we'll talk about in a little bit. And so, but Zimri assassinates Elah. What is Elah doing? What noble thing is he got going on in his life when he gets attacked and assassinated by Zimri? And any comments on that?
So that'll be over in 1 Kings 16.
Yes.
If you're looking to kind of get yourself in the general zone. I know we've not been doing a lot of referencing specific verses as we go through this. And 1 Kings 16, what was he doing?
1 Kings 16 and in verse 9, we'll help you out there a little bit.
There you go.
And see, everybody drinking. Would like
to. There you go. Yep. We got the answer, Paul. Drunk, he was drinking himself drunk.
Drunk. So that's how you'd like to be remembered. Well, how did old Harry go out? Oh, man, he was hiring a kite and just died in his chair with alcohol all over me. Oh, man, he's got a name, but that's not the kind of name you want to have. Yeah. And so what you have are these guys, they come in, they rule for 24 years or 2 years. But you don't come away saying the nation was better. Mm-hmm. He's a better person. He was really a blessing. Nah, every one of them, man, in the wrong direction.
And then now you're right where Proverbs says too, where Proverbs even specifically said, look, son, drinking wine is not for kings. This is a great example of that, isn't it?
Yes, great point. Then you get this guy here is the next guy is absolutely amazing. He has this name that goes down in history, and he's the tank commander, and he's Israel's fifth king, and he ruled 7 days.
Ironically, he's one of the kings that I remember just because he ruled for such a short amount of time. But I mean, the point still stands. Like, the only thing he's remembered for is he couldn't hold the kingdom for a week. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty rough.
So here's Zimri the Zero. And so just, man, 1 week and that's all. And so, yeah, you attacked a drunk guy and now you are king. And in fact, then you wipe out Baasha's whole family line, their relatives and their friends and their dog and their cats. And
which all happens within a 7 day time period, right? So this is a slaughter.
Yes, yes. This guy wastes no time. I'm getting rid of all my potential political enemies. Well, what happened was he was the tank commander while the rest of the guys are fighting in the field. He gets a certain contingent, goes up and kills Baasha and appoints himself king. The rest of the army finds out about it and they say, oh, man, we didn't appoint you king. Yeah. This was not a democratic vote. And so the guy we'll talk about in a little bit will be Omri. And so we're still talking about Zimri, the 7 day wonder. And so they attack the city and the palace where Zimri is. And Zimri has a battle plan. He has a plan for dealing with his political enemies as they attack the city and then trap him in the palace. Does anybody know what extreme measure of bravery was shown by Zimri when his enemies were closing in? That'll be for 150 points. If you don't get it, Scott will. Nobody gonna bite on that, huh?
He burns the house down on himself.
On him. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I could think of a number of ways. I'm not ready to be bumped off right tonight, but if you say, Paul, you're going to be bumped off tonight. That's, you just get to choose.
That wouldn't be your pick?
Yeah, if I get to pick, burning the house down around my ears would not be my first choice.
Yeah. You know, I wondered a little bit if what that says about the state of how vicious the nation was at that time, that he knew what was coming and he somehow thought that that would be worse. You know, you do hear about military coups in especially third world countries and areas of the world that are a lot more barbaric than what we're used to. It's pretty rough. You get drugged through the streets and taken apart bit by bit. I've wondered a little bit with him, did he fear what will happen if my enemies get a hold of me? But he really does highlight there is a very big difference between acquiring leadership or power and keeping it. They are very different things.
There's a couple of things we might comment on this guy. And because that very point that you brought up really, I wrestled with for quite a while, because I thought, why in the world? I mean, burning my house down around my ears would not be my, you say, Paul, we're going to shoot you. All right. Put it right between the eyes and just make her quick. One of the commentators, Bible Knowledge Commentary, since the Bible doesn't say, it's just right. Their guess. They said his plan was to do as much damage as he could to Jeroboam's palace to deny it to his rival. And then he suicides.
Yeah.
Wow. The thing that I would like to bounce off and take a little side trail just for 2 minutes is sometimes on a practical basis, we deal with friends or somebody we know that's considering suicide. And I'll just say two things, and then maybe you as students will have some suggestions. And the first thing is sometimes we feel like maybe here's so-and-so that I know, and they're starting to give away their precious things, and they're more feeling remote and isolated and uncommunicative. They're not being normal. And you know, then they start talking about, well, if I wasn't here anymore, I don't know that it would matter. And people, not always, but sometimes will give little clues. That's what they're thinking. The first principle I'd like to talk about is if somebody's talking about it, don't be bashful about asking. I took a class in suicide intervention because I've lost two friends to suicide. And one was a person in their 20s and one was in their 40s. And you think, boy, if I say it, you know, maybe that's being too intrusive, too da, da, da. Ask them, can I ask you a question? Are you thinking about, and you say it in the way that seems most natural for you. Can I ask you a question? Are you thinking about hurting yourself? Are you thinking about ending your own life? Are you thinking about taking your life? And if they say, well, you know, I want to say, but I mean, it's crossed my mind, which if they say that, it means they have, and it's a big deal. You ask, you're asking certain questions to see if you can find out how imminent it is. And so you ask, are they thinking about it? Have they thought about how they're going to do it? If they, no, I just wondered somehow or another. I was, oh yeah, I know. They're going to shoot themselves or pills or something. And if they say, well, I'm taking my own life with a gun, Do you have the gun? Do you have ammunition for the gun? See, you say, oh man, I couldn't ask that. You could if you want to save their life. Because if they've got the gun, it's in their hand or in their purse or in the house, or they got a gun, but they don't have ammunition. What you ask before they use it, they, you just want to say, Caroline or Gerald or whatever their name is, I want you to promise me something. You won't hurt yourself till I get there. And most of the time they'll say, okay. And you get them some help. I've had people call me. They said, look, I've been thinking of ending my life. And I said, do you have the weapon? Yes. Where is it? It's in my backpack. Okay. They're serious. And you can get them some help. Anything else you've thought about in how to help people? This is a side note, of course, from Kings, but it's brought up because of this individual, Zimri. Anything else you can think about how to help somebody if they're considering suicide? You can think about that. And then maybe they do, maybe they don't. Scott, why don't you talk to us? And by the way, Zimri becomes a byword for traitor and murderer.
Yeah, he becomes the Benedict Arnold of their nation.
Yes.
You know, along the lines of what you're saying, Paul, I think one really simple thing to do is, if you have any questions, be frank with people, be upfront. And if they're not considering it, they will then begin to consider the way they sound. And that, you know, so, and that's not a bad thing either. So
I like Jordan's comments, sit with them, listen, because let me share one parallel that when I heard this, I thought, because we thought, oh, that's the coward's way out. That's just the way they're desperate. They're hopeless and they don't have another way to turn. In a college class, the psych professor said, picture a room that is itself all walls, all surfaces are cased in metal. So picture stainless steel. Even the floor is just a mesh, a grid, but it's stainless steel. There's furniture in the room. There's a table, but it's stainless steel. The chairs are. There's one door and it's locked. And everybody's wearing tennis shoes but you. The metal is electrified. It's painful to be in there. And nobody else seems to notice. The idea is you're in the same environment as the rest of society and they're going on about their lives and they don't feel the pain that this person does. And it just continues day after day after day. And there's one window. What would you do? So that's that feeling of I'm trapped. Nobody else feels what I feel. Mm-hmm. And there's only this escape. So what you're trying to share with them, I care about you more than I can express. Let's see if we can get you some help.
Mm-hmm. God bless. Find their point of pain that they're at, even though it's not the same as yours. If you can find a way to figure out what it is, it's huge. Okay, so moving on from Zimri, we move on to Omri. Now, Omri really, depending on how you put it, there's another guy in there, Tibni, but there's kind of a civil war that goes on during this time period. But Omri's the guy who eventually prevails. He comes out on top, reigns, what was it, about 12 years, I think, and not a good guy. Verse 25 of chapter 16 says, Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord and acted more wickedly than all who were before him, for he walked in the way of Jeroboam the son of Nebat and his sins which made Israel sin, provoking the Lord God of Israel with their idols. So he was also idolatrous. We'll find this through the whole thing. Jeroboam, once you opened the bag, you couldn't put the idols back in. You know, you really, once you ring that bell, that was a part of the northern kingdom's history from that point forward were those golden calves. Omri, just like Jeroboam, but then he's going to bring in the next generation who will do far worse in Ahab. But Omri, from what we could tell, was well-respected. The people chose when word came that Zimri had taken over, the people decided we want this guy instead. So he, there was a level of respect that he had from the people, but we might question the quality of the people in the nation at that point too. So there's kind of the other thing. It's like, well, if all the people in a wicked nation think you're great, maybe there's a problem. So he fits into that category. He seems to be just another version of Jeroboam, although not inventing anything new. And a military strategist, right? So he comes from a military background, which we see a lot of the time, not just in the history of the Northern tribes, but just in history in general, military leaders often become dictators and rulers. So with him, he's going to rule for about 12 years, then be replaced by his son, who will then step up the game. And, you know, we got about 9 minutes or so left in class. I don't know if we can fully do Ahab justice, but we might be able to get some of the beginnings in there. He is a guy we learn a lot about, and we can talk a lot about his character. But the inception of his reign begins with him taking one extra step, which is the others have had idolatry with the golden calves, but now he's going to introduce not just idolatry, but other gods. The it's kind of a weird way to put it, but the idols were still representative of Jehovah. Is that a fair way to put that, Paul? They're still trying to represent, this is the God that led you out of Egypt, but now we've got something else.
They would, if you're talking about the golden calves, because wrongly, but that is the language that Aaron used. Moses up on the mountain for 40 days, and Aaron's down there building a golden calf. Behold, these are the gods that let you out of Egypt. Well, why is that? Well, because Egypt had idolatrous religion, and Apis of Memphis was worshipped in the form of a bull. Mm-hmm. Well, they'd been there their whole lives, and so this was not foreign territory to them. But when you come across Ahab, and he marries the Sidonian princess Jezebel.
Which has gone down as a great, beloved female name, by the way. Oh, right, man. So everybody, she just turned out to be a gem.
Their daughter's Jezebel, don't they? They name their cat Jezebel, but not their daughters. But think what she brought in. The at worship of Baal, and he built a temple for Baal on Mount Samaria, made the Asherah, the Phoenician goddess of sexual fertility. What he's done is he married a foreigner. And here's the baggage she brought with her. Let me ask you this, Scott, in class you can think about it, because I've changed my mind on this couple. I guess I've been leaning that way for a long time, not from that they were bad and now good. Which was the stronger personality, Ahab or Jezebel? What do you think?
I know what I think, but now I'm curious what you think. I think Jezebel. Yeah. I think Jezebel's the stronger personality. I think Ahab was the patsy very early on. By choice, he got what he wanted. So he's not off the hook, but I definitely feel like Jezebel is. How about you, Paul?
I do too, and I like what people say. Yeah, Jezebel for sure. Ahab was a whiner, and that's right, because as you look at him, as he looks at Elijah, well, he's blaming Elijah for the problems. You troubler of Israel, and then who was that class? Who was that guy? He wanted his little vineyard. He wanted for a vegetable garden. And the guy's like, I was given it by my father's inheritance. That's right, Naboth. And so what does this strong, manly, square-jawed, broad-chested, wide-shouldered guy do when he can't get the piece of ground for his vegetable garden? Oh, well, he's sullen and vexed, and he pouts, and he won't eat. And his sweet wife is going to cheer him up. I tell you, honey, I can take care of it. I will solve your problems. We just get false witnesses, bribe them, stone Naboth to death. What do we care? You got your vegetable garden. I go, wow. couple lessons that we can gain from that. One of them, Lord willing, Steve Grimes has asked me, while Scott's down there doing nothing but vacationing in Disney World, Florida. Well, that's not true. He's working his heart out and all this red tape trying to get the adoption done. And we admire you and respect you so much for that. Steve Grimes, elder at Monroe, said, Paul, would you come and cover? Yes, be glad to. And I want to preach a sermon that I've not preached before. This is a little plug for that. I've preached pieces of it, but I've never put it one. I want to talk Sunday on the strong women of the Bible and how that applies to the women today. I am not going through the worthy woman, Proverbs. That was an ideal woman. I'm taking the real women, because godly women you are, and we appreciate you for that. Scott and I, we got a couple more minutes. Say a little bit more about Ahab, his attitudes, or his wife, or his death, or however you want to cover our last couple minutes.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we look at Ahab, you have a guy who was Jewish, but now he's introducing a foreign wife and her foreign culture. Like, he's embracing her immoral culture. We're not just talking about, hey, let's try some food from over there. We're talking about cultural things that have nothing to do with following God. And I think that that's a pivotal change in the leadership, because up until that point, if you take Jeroboam and the golden calves, he's trying to pervert and twist to his own means the worship of God, but he still says, hey, we'll have our own priesthood. In fact, anybody can be priest, but we still are going to do this priesthood thing. We're still going to worship the God that led you out of Egypt. We're still going to have the feasts and the festivals. So we're going to try and make it look a lot like Judaism, which is not okay by any means. It's still a counterfeit, and sometimes it's the most dangerous, right? Because it looked close enough to the truth to lead people astray. But now we've removed even the pretenses of it. And I think that that's what Ahab goes down for, is the guy who just says, look, we're not even pretending to follow Jehovah anymore. We're just going to do whatever we want. And when he entered in with that, you very quickly see who takes charge. That not only does Jezebel take charge, but the false prophets take charge. I mean, one of the most well-known events in Ahab's reign is Elijah and Mount Carmel and all the prophets. And so there's hundreds of false prophets and one Elijah.
Yeah.
So that change happened during his time period. And his wife had a lot to do with it. But look, he's the guy who married her. So, everything Jezebel does, you can't just put it on Jezebel. You also have to say, Ahab, where were you? And I think right. That's another leadership point too, isn't it?
Even on Mount Carmel, it's not Ahab holding up the sword of Baal. He's kind of, I have to go back and tell the wife, I didn't kill them all.
Mm-hmm.
And so think about this. Ahab, in a final battle in 1 Kings 22, decided, hey, they're not going to get me. I'm going to dress up in clothes where they don't know I'm a king. Archer draws his bow, lets fly an arrow, hits him in a joint armor, kills him. Here's the providence of God. As then Jehu is ready to wipe out that family line, you got to take out Jezebel. And how about this? Just before she's murdered, she's putting on her makeup so she looks pretty as she's pushed out the window. Just before she addresses Jehu with this really cutting epitaph, is that you, Zimri, your master's murderer? So going all the way back to the guy who ruled 7 days and killed himself and assassinated. And of course, Jehu, whoever's on the Lord's side, pushes her out, horses trample her, the dogs eat her. Wow. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain who build it. My last comment before turning back to you, Scott, is Christians, think about this. Other people have this, all this, their names up in lights. You be that star-studded personal evangelist. You be the person that Daniel talks about in chapter 12 and verse 3, who will be like the stars that shine forever and ever. Your name will be up in lights. You'll be lights in heaven. And I'm so grateful that you are. Scott?
Yeah, I think as we look at all these different leaders and we're closing out here tonight, just the thing that we want to do is look at their character and then kind of let those synapses fire in your own brain and say, okay, how can I learn from that? And then in the leadership roles that I have in my life, whether it be as a husband or a wife or a father or a mother, a supervisor, maybe, you know, in charge of other employees, any sort of leadership example, maybe it's just being a role model to those around. You know, you can be a young person and have other young people looking up to you, go, okay, what can I learn from these people and then apply in my circumstance? So that's the meditative part. And so what we want to do is, as students, is kind of go, okay, let's look at these guys and then look at our own life and say, what can I learn from them? Am I a fearful leader? If so, how do I change that? Am I willing to make compromises in character to get what I want? Okay, what's the consequences of that? Those sorts of things. And these kings are a really great example of the northern kings, especially. It's a pretty quick downhill slope. So you kind of really quickly get to see where these things go and how the people around them are affected by that leadership. And, you know, one of the things we want to do is we want to wake up at the end of our lives. And when we stand before God, you know, we're going to go to sleep and then wake up. And when we wake up, we want to say, what I did with the time I had down there, it was not just for me. It was
a great point.
The other people around me. So that'll be it for tonight. And then we're going to pick up from here and continue through the Northern Kingdom next week, same time, 7 o'clock. Just thank you everybody for your time. Paul, any other classes and whatnot you want people to know about?
No, you got 10,000 of them going on. It's bewildering to me. But a point I was going to make, as you talked about, here's the king. They're great examples of a lot of times what not to do. But Christians, I want to address you, that we see their example and we're struck by it for good or bad. But each one of us sets an example. Parents, you set that for your kids. Christians, you set it for other Christians. And we look at the kings and we say, wow. People look at your lives and say, wow. I was a young man. I was probably 25 back in the Kirkland days, way back when, before Rose Hill, had a little building, I think, up on 9th. And an elder back, one that became an elder at that time, Steve Austin, many of you know or know of, said to me, as I'm 25, he said, Paul, watch where you put your feet. I looked at him, what do you mean? And he mentioned this other brother who was older than I, had been married for several years, a bigger person than I. And he said, Paul, wherever you put your feet, they put their feet. Totally surprised me. I didn't expect it. I thought, I'm just this young guy getting started. Somebody's watching you. And you're their example. Set a good one. God bless.
Have a wonderful night, everybody. Love you all. And we will do this again, Lord willing, next Wednesday at 7 o'clock.
Be blessed. Bye-bye.